Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Ballmer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Ilana Levine.
Our kids have said to us since we moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, the values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.
Little known back to the day, every little thing's gonna be A-OK. A-OK.
Hey everyone, new episodes of Little Known Facts drop every Monday and you can find them on your favorite podcast provider. Also, if you go to the website, littleknownfactspodcast.com, you'll find behind-the-scenes photos, videos, and interviews, and lots more on the gallery page. And if you are loving these intimate, candid conversations with all the artists who come on the show, please head over to the contributions page. I depend on these donations to continue to bring you these interviews every week. So if you love the show, please donate. Hey, everyone. I hope you're having a great day. The response was kind of overwhelming to my episode, American Audition Horror Stories, and I decided that I was going to try it again. So this time, I've put together an episode filled with some of my favorite reveals from interviews I've done, and I think you're going to love it. So here we go. Here's the first one.
A-OK.
As a child of a single working mother growing up in New York City, Laura Linney was on her own a lot. In this anecdote about her childhood, Laura tells us the story of a very unlikely babysitter who was always looking out for her.
So I was a latchkey kid,
right?
You know, and there were many of us during that time. It was not unusual for kids to be, you know, out and in hanging out in Central Park after school and getting to school by yourself.
What part of the city?
64th between 1st and York,
okay.
near the hospital. It was a different type of New York where most stores were privately owned. There were small businesses everywhere. And they knew the neighborhood. Like, everyone knew that there was this nurse who had this kid. And they all sort of made sure I was okay and how you doing. And Rocky Graziano lived in my building, which was a riot. So, and he was always like, you know, anybody bothers you, you tell me Uncle Rocky, he'll come and give him a one or two. And he dated twins, which I loved.
Were they identical?
Yeah, they were identical twins with like long blonde hair and they wore cowboy hats. And he would put one hand in one back pocket and one in the other and sort of, you know, manage them up and down the street. It was hysterical.
Oh,
but I loved him. He was very, very sweet to me.
Uncle Rocky.
He was Uncle Rocky. You know, and I felt very protected.
Yeah.
But, you know, the neighborhood sort of looked out for me.
On January 25, 1996, at the young age of 35, Jonathan Larson, the playwright and composer of the international hit musical Rent, was found dead in his New York City apartment. Earlier that evening, the cast of Rent had performed the final dress rehearsal to an ecstatic audience. Jonathan didn't live to see what quickly became the Broadway phenomenon of his musical, but Rent star Anthony Rapp was on the podcast, and he told me the story of his last night with Jonathan Larson. Here it is.
December 24th, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. From here on in, I shoot without a script. See if anything comes of it instead of my old shit.
We were doing it at the New York Theater Workshop.
Okay.
He was alive for the dress rehearsal.
Right.
The invited dress rehearsal. Our mutual friend, John Benjamin Hickey. I'll never forget his reaction after the show, he ran up to me and he went, "You guys are all fucking incredible. I wanted to fuck each and every one of you."
That's the highest praise.
I know.
What higher praise is there? Especially from John Benjamin Hickey. Wow.
Yeah, no, Jonathan was very much alive for the dress rehearsal. I mean, I've been a part of some really, you know, 6 degrees of separation was a big deal.
Yep.
I had a small part in it.
Yes,
it was a very big deal. But
yes.
I can remember the dress rehearsal for 6 degrees of separation. We were playing the Mitzi Newhouse, which in Lincoln Center is this small theater downstairs, and the Beaumont is the Broadway theater upstairs, which was playing Some Americans Abroad, which is a pretty quiet play.
Right.
The laughter and cheering from 6 degrees of separation went through the ceiling so that the actors on stage of Some Americans Abroad were hearing it. It was that electric. So that was my closest sort of touchstone. And then Six Degrees went on to be this huge success. The Rent dress rehearsal was like that. And Jonathan was surrounded by people afterwards. And it wasn't just his friends, I promise you.
He had it though. He got to experience that.
So people glommed on him, wanted to talk to him. You know, my agent, tears in her eyes, shaking, you know, so that happened. And the New York Times had sent Anthony Tomasini. He was I don't know what his job is currently still, but he was writing for the classical music stuff. And it was the 100th anniversary of La Boheme.
Right. So perfect.
Coincided.
A perfect story.
So he's like, oh, I should go check out this East Village adaptation. So he just happened to be there. He wasn't reviewing it, you know, just to have included in his piece.
Mm-hmm.
He was so struck by what he'd seen that he asked Jonathan to sit for an on-the-spot interview. So, you know, Jonathan, 35 years old, had been plugging away. Nothing had happened and was on the verge. And he knew, you know, one of the things that's been the 20th anniversary this year. And so, like, his old friend Victoria Leacock has been sharing some stories. And the other day she posted something about Facebook because people were talking about, like, the different perceptions of how much can we know how much he did know or didn't know of what was to come. And she was like, no, absolutely, he knew that he had a hit. Again, you never know for sure, but he was so confident. I mean, that brings me some comfort. So the last time I saw him was through the box office window, which was the only quiet place in the little New York Theater Workshop place. That was the only place to go, was where he was doing his interview with Anthony Tomasini. He knew enough about everything to know that an interview with the New York Times is a big deal. So I saw him, and of course I was going to see him the next day. And then he went home afterwards and he put on a kettle on the stove to make some tea and he dropped dead on his kitchen floor. And his roommate came home in the middle of the night and found him.
525,600 minutes. 525,000 moments, oh dear.
My next guest, Griffin Dunn, is going to share a story with you. He had just gotten to New York City. I think on the day this story happened, he was about to start acting class with the renowned Uta Hagen, acting teacher to many greats. And he had on this really great coat. And he walked into a supermarket and he was really surprised to find that he could fit as many things into his coat pocket as he could into a shopping cart. And so he did, and this turned out to be not such a great idea. Here's Griffin.
I went to the Neighborhood Playhouse, and my first week there, before I went to the class, I went to the A&P across the street, the supermarket, and I went to just get like a few things, and I had an enormous coat. And one of the things was Cheese Whiz. I don't know.
Delicious. What do you mean you don't know? If they had Triscuits, that's the best day ever.
So I loaded up and I realized my pockets were so big. I thought, why am I paying for this?
Crazy.
Look at these pockets and look how few items. It caught the attention of the security guard who informed the New York City police. And so I was arrested and led by in handcuffs in front of the Neighborhood Playhouse. First year student, and they're taking the back of my head and putting it under the door, and I've still got my big coat on, and I'm taken to, you know, the tombs.
Oh my God.
And I go from cell to cell to cell, you know, waiting for night court. I was there 7 in the morning. We're now like 3 in the morning. I've earned the nomenclature the Cheese Whiz Kid. The other inmates found it hilarious.
Of course.
That I took Cheese Whiz.
Because the other inmate was like, killed 7 people on my way.
My last...
Son of Sam? That was the other guy.
Wait, Great guy.
He was so sweet. Misunderstood.
Absolutely. He brought his own hot plate. but anyway, actually,
does anyone have a Ritz cracker? Oh no.
Okay. We were all going to go to Rikers if the judge didn't get me. And Rikers, I was not looking forward to. It was all fun and games until we had to go to Rikers. And I'm in the final cell before I finally get to the judge. It's taken all day, and I'm in a cell with, I'm 18, these two kids are 17. The way I know that is they're reading the latest edition of the New York Post, of which they're on the cover for killing a Columbia student.
You've got to be kidding.
And they're looking at their picture. I'm not so sure. And they're like a couple of actors, you know, complaining about their headshot. And then a cop comes in and goes, oh, we can only take one of you. That's my English, Irish accent.
Okay.
He wasn't old O'Reilly. Anyway, he said, we can only take one of you. We'll take the youngest one here. And I said, I'm the youngest.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're the only non-murderer.
And I don't say I'm Irish. I'm Irish, just like you.
I'm Griffin. Paddy. My Teaneck Irish accent is fantastic. So I'll take you, meaning you get to see the judge.
Oh, I get to see the
right?
judge.
That's
the judge
what it
goes,
meant.
Why is this in my courtroom? He brings the security guard to the bench.
I'm picturing Harry Anderson from like the sitcom Night yeah. Court. Like, first of all, give me that Triscuit. Bring that here, young man.
Yeah, exactly.
Bring that cheese whiz.
It was a total sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of yelling at me, he yelled at the security guard for arresting me. And then he was shamefaced, and I had to take a subway back. And we were the only two on the platform at the end of
you and Earl. You're like, I'm really sorry about the cheese whiz.
Yeah, really, yeah.
So you don't have a record from that?
I've wanted to look for it, but I can't find it.
But you can travel freely between countries. You're not like Roman Polanski.
No,
like, you're allowed back.
No.
You're allowed back in when you leave.
Absolutely.
Gee, Officer Krupke, we're very upset. We never had the love that every child ought to get. We ain't no delinquents, we're misunderstood. Deep down inside us, there is good.
There is good.
So my friend Cynthia Nixon is an only child, and coincidentally, both of her parents were also only children. And she grew up in New York City. Her parents were pretty bohemian. And there was this expectation, as she describes it, that she would always fit into their very adult world. And so she very quickly learned how to be an adult. So here she is filling me in on life in the Nixon household.
I feel like this is a segue into an important part of me, right? Which is that my mother had me late for the time that she was living in the 60s. She was 36 when she had me. I was her only child. She wasn't planning on having children. I'm an only child, and she was an only child, and my father was an only child. You know, there was not a lot of, my childhood that was kid stuff. There was a lot of, like, you're five now. Let's go see Stacy Keach in Hamlet. You know, there was a lot of movies and plays. Mm. And partly maybe because I was way too young for
right,
these things that
right.
I was seeing, but also because I think it was what my mother loved to do, we would go. But that was what we had to talk about.
Right.
We didn't talk about our feelings.
No.
We didn't talk about my imaginary friends. We talked about both of our imaginary people that we'd seen up on stage. Because my parents were old, and because they had me, like, my mother was 36, my dad was 44, which at the time, to have a child, like,
right.
My mother would clip articles out of the paper about Cary Grant, be like, he's old, and
See?
He's a dad, and look how happy he is.
Right.
Kids, I don't know what's wrong with these kids today. Kids, who can understand anything they say?
Now, quite the reverse of being an only child is my husband Dominic Famusa's story, where Dominic is one of 10 children, 9 out of 10, actually, and he's also a twin. And here he tells us what it was like growing up in a house with that many kids and only one refrigerator.
You know, I get asked about my big family, and I always say it's like I didn't think twice about it. I mean, it didn't really occur to me that this was totally strange. I mean, obviously, most kids I knew did not have anywhere near as many siblings as I did. But, you know, I had this healthy sense as a child that whatever I did, whatever my parents were doing was like the thing that should be done.
That's nice. Know?
Yeah, it was. It was good.
Do you feel like it made you feel special?
You know, because I had so many older siblings, my name carried a certain, you know, cachet, as it were, as I went through the school system. So that was kind of cool because most of my siblings, I think, had made a good impression on most teachers before I got there. So you kind of start the day with, you know, with a good check mark already mm-hmm. in there.
When you share the same last name as nine other people in a community, how do you get noticed for being an individual?
I was a little different in that I was very into sports and I was, sports was something that I, at my level at that school, I excelled at. So mm-hmm. I was the starting quarterback. I was this, you know, one of the starting pitchers on the baseball team. I was the starting point guard on the basketball team. So that was one way to sort of, you know, create an identity, you know, of my own. But, you know, getting back to this idea, I had a very healthy sense of security. And I remember, which I think looking back was sort of kind of unwarranted, but
why?
My dad, I think, you know, there was a lot of pressure to raise 10 children and, I'm sure it was stressful, but I never,
you weren't aware of that.
Well, not as a young person for sure. And things would happen where like things would break down in our house, or like, I remember, we had a blacktop driveway that was crumbling and, you know, my friends would be like, when are you guys going to, you know, get this paved over? And I'd be like, oh no, we like it this way. This is a choice, you know.
Those aren't weeds. That's, you know, a garden.
Or like my friends would come over and open the refrigerator because they couldn't believe that my father had bought more than 1 gallon of milk at a time. And like they would play a game before they opened it where they like they bet how many gallons are going to be in the fridge when they open it. And I think the record was 5 gallons of milk.
Continuing now with some of my favorite reveals from Little Known Facts is Molly Ringwald. Molly grew up with a blind father, but that never seemed unusual to her. It was more unusual that he was a jazz musician who worked completely different hours than most of her friends' dads. So listen as Molly describes her take on growing up with her jazz musician dad. Have a moment where you realize, like, oh, my dad isn't like other dads, where you had an understanding that he was special in all of these ways?
To me, he was always special because he was just so different from everyone else. And it really, the blindness was, I would say, a little bit low on the list. You know, he was a musician. You know, it was the 70s. He had a big bushy beard. I've never actually seen my father without a beard. He grew a goatee when he was about 15 so he could work in clubs.
Uh-huh.
He had dark hair. I mean, he was very striking to look at. And I remember my friends sometimes would be scared of him at first because he looked so different than all the dads
right.
looked in the 70s, you
right.
know? And also he kept different hours. You know, he didn't wake up and go to work like all the other dads did, you know?
Right.
He slept late and then he would pretty much work all night in clubs. And, you know, that's how he supported the family was, you know, as a working musician. And also he had a different sense of humor. My dad has a little bit of a subversive sense of humor and he just always seemed very confident. It seemed to me that he could do anything he wanted to do.
Amazing.
You know, he would get up on the roof and fix the antenna, or he would, you know, he would put shelves together, and, you know, he's better at giving directions than anyone else. And, you know, he did all of the scheduling in the house because my mom hates to talk on the phone. And, you know, it was never really an issue. And of course, I never grew up with a different dad, so I didn't
Right.
really have much to compare it to.
Catherine Irby, who is just the most magnificent actress, who many people know from her years on Law and Order Criminal Intent, although her film and theater career is pretty incredible as well. But she tells a very personal and intimate story on the podcast about a huge thing that happened to her when she was in high school. And this is her telling me about the decision to leave high school before it was done. So here's Catherine. And I really want to thank her for sharing this. The response to this story has been extraordinary. It is incredibly inspiring, and I'm sure you will find it as such.
I just hit my teenage years and was found myself to be deeply unhappy.
Okay.
And really angry. And I felt then that I had been this good little girl
right.
my whole
You did it all right.
life. I did it all right. I had this smile on my face. And I didn't feel anything. You know, it was all my head, really. I wasn't really connected from the neck down. And there was also something really romantic about suffering
yes.
and suffering for love. And I had these weird ideas like that. It was just finding myself unhappy. Mm-hmm. And I kind of took a rebellious turn. And I was tired of pleasing my parents and really tired of the grind of being a good student. And I actively sought out a group of friends that were kind of in the same path. Mm. And we all went down the drain together, pretty much.
So what grade was this when you sort of checked out of traditional school?
My junior year mm-hmm. of high school, I dropped out. And, you know, I don't talk about it a lot because I feel like it brings it, – it's a hard thing to talk about.
Of course.
It's painful, I think, for my parents. You know, I felt a lot of shame about it. But more and more, I feel like it might help people for
Absolutely.
Me to talk about it. I mean, I was really lucky. You know, I got into cars with people who were drunk and we crashed and – You know, I probably shouldn't be here given the odds, but I've always sort of felt like I had a guardian angel or some kind of, you know, spirit in me that was gonna survive. And I was really lucky. I mean, my parents cared deeply about me. So I dropped out of school. I left home. I lived in my best friend's with my best friend's family. And it was when I was living with my best friend's family that I dropped out, and my parents saw that as a real warning sign. Mm-hmm. And we had found this alternative high school that was in Western Massachusetts called the DeSisto at Stockbridge School, which was basically a therapeutic community. And they mortgaged their house, and they sent me to this school. And initially, it was kind of against my will. I had a schedule that I wanted to do it on. It was certainly right. that I wasn't going to go during the summer. I was, you know.
No.
No, certainly
not. With Crystal
not.
Lake there. With you.
Exactly. Nantasket Beach. I had plans, and they...
Hilarious. Thwarted.
Yeah, they were thwarted.
Plan thwarters.
Exactly.
I knew it.
Exactly. And so I went to the school, and there were, you know, my people.
When Matthew Broderick was starting out, he was very well known very quickly for being in this trilogy of Neil Simon plays on Broadway. One of the plays did a national tour either before or after it came to Broadway. I can't remember, but this one was called Brighton Beach Memoirs. And it was an autobiographical play. And Matthew basically plays Neil Simon in these plays. And they were all very much focused on what it was like to grow up as Neil Simon in Brooklyn. And one night in the story that Matthew shared with me, he talks about one of the best onstage pranks that ever happened. And this is between him and an actor named Tim Busfield. And all right, I'll let Matthew tell it.
I have a secret desire hiding deep in my soul. It sets my heart afire to see me in this role.
Tim Busfield was
30-something
of 30-something fame and a very good director, too, and a great fellow. He was my understudy, as it happened, in Brighton Beach Memoirs. We were very young. We were in San Francisco and at Fisherman's Wharf, like this touristy kind of area, and there was some kind of joke shop, and I bought a little package of candy that was tasted of garlic. It starts out good. I think it was gum or a sucker. And it's hilarious because the person thinks it's really good. And they have it for a while, and then it tastes really bad. And so it's really funny. And I gave a piece to Tim, and I was like, it's going to taste funny, but if you stick with it, you know, it's going to, believe me, it's worth it. This is the most delicious thing I've ever had. And I gave it to him, and he really sucked on it, and really, you know, it worked. It looked just like the picture that the candy came in, like the guy slapping his forehead and going, garlic, you know, it was awful. And it all worked perfectly, and I was so happy with my joke.
A really good prank.
My prank, yes. And then that night in the show, I had a very long piece of this. I would read from my journal, and there was one very long, like, you know, single-spaced page thing that I would read, and I had it in my actual journal because I thought, why would I learn that? I should just read it. So I opened to the page to read this little monologue, and it's gone. There's just a piece of paper over it. And written in very big pencil is garlic, comma, ha, exclamation point. And I'm in the middle of, you know, this is a 1,500 seat theater or something, like 1,200. And I look up, and by the light behind the orchestra, I can see Tim Busfield with his red hair laughing under the light. And it's horrible.
I remember the day my sisters brought home the album Purple Rain. We listened to it, our minds were blown, and from that moment on, we were Prince fans. And when he passed this year, it was devastating. When Kristen Chenoweth came on the show and told me how she first came to know him and become close friends with him, it's to this day one of the highlights of my time as a podcast host. So I'm so thrilled to get to share with you Kristen's story of the day her manager called and said, hey, what are you doing? Prince wants to meet you. Here's Kristen telling it.
I knew him for a time, and he was, over the years, very encouraging to me. Mm. And, you know, even though he was a friend that I didn't see.
So how did you even connect?
My then manager called me and said, Prince would like to meet you, you know, invite you to dinner. So I think I'm going there thinking I'm having dinner with a group, and it's just me and him, and all he wanted to do was talk about music.
At his home?
Yes.
So you're like, oh, okay.
Yes.
And you're writing down 433. Yeah. Okay.
That's so exactly. And I drove up, and there was this huge gate with right. The symbol of Prince when he was not Prince.
Oh, the Ankh. Yeah. Yes.
On the door.
Formerly known as Prince.
That's right. Yes. And then there was a big, it was like Little Orphan Annie's mansion, and there was a big staircase with a purple rug, and there was somebody waiting for me to greet me and take me into the library. And
who, like a butler? Like
yes.
Formal?
Yes.
Okay.
And
Ms. Chenoweth.
And it was so, I'm like, I think I was in a, I remember being in a Gap jacket. I was like, oh, I should have dressed up.
Yeah, you should have.
He took me, you know I should have. And took me to the library. And I wasn't snooping, but it's hard not to.
With Colonel Mustard and a candlestick. Got it.
Exactly. So I'm looking around, and I look in, and I see that he has a Bible, and he has some really other cool books. And I thought, and he's definitely a spiritual person, and of course we got on great. And
most of us have not been in that situation, although we have been in libraries of people we don't know, maybe waiting for them to come down. But what's right. The very first moment? Like, this is Prince. Do you know what to call him even?
Okay.
How does he introduce himself?
Okay, Prince.
Okay.
So there's this long hallway, and it was marble, and I heard... And I got nervouser and nervouser and nervouser, right. And it took forever. It was the longest clicking heels coming down a hallway I'd ever heard. I thought it would never. And he comes in, and he's looking fantastically hot, just how he was.
He's beautiful.
He was, and he had his hair, and he had on a white silk suit. And he said, hi, Kristen. I'm so glad you came. And I went, I don't know what to say to you right now. And I think I said, do I call you Prince? What do I? And he goes, you call me Prince, but you just relax. I just want to tell you how much you've inspired me. I remember when we had salmon, which I don't eat fish, you know. And I just remember hearing my mom's voice go, you choke that salmon down. Eat it.
You tough love.
Exactly.
You mentioned the tough love. Mothers and daughters. You eat that salmon.
That's exactly what
I'm going to beat you.
I'm going to get you with that salmon. And I choked it down, Alana, with my water. Oh. And then he goes, I want to show you something. I just loved to watch, and took me down to his movie room, and he played Candide, this opera I did for PBS, and he played the aria I sang, and I said, we don't have to watch this. He goes, no, I think it's important when someone inspires you that you admire and you look at their skill. I want you to know that this is inspiring to me. And I mean, really?
So you're watching your performance in the opera with him?
With Prince. I said, right. Is Prince showing me?
What's happening right
now? Yeah, I was like, no. And then he said, you want to see my guitars? And guitars? And I said,
whoa.
I said, yes,
I do.
I said,
well,
yes.
Thank you. Who are you all of a sudden?
I don't know. All of a sudden I've become...
You're Loretta Lynn.
I've become Christy Dawn is what happened.
You were.
Which you know her.
We go right back. Yes.
So we go down. I'm glad you asked me this.
Yes.
So we go down and we see all these guitars in this other room. I mean, probably 30 on stands. And he said, do you want to play one? I said, yeah, I'm terrible. But I picked up he goes, pick up that white one. And I picked it up. It had a pretty long grip. He goes, flip it over. And I flipped it over and it was all scratched. I said, what happened? He goes, that was Elvis's belt.
Okay.
I'm like, if I had a dog.
We're out. We're out.
It's very hard not to be intimidated.
Yeah.
And I said, I can't believe you have his guitar. And he goes, oh, I loved him. But I'm glad you said you loved him, because what an incredible person and musician. And I know there's all this cloud of things around his death, but I choose to really look at the way he lived.
And so you stayed friends.
Yeah. Every once in a while, he would say, I saw you on this and you're great. And another time he'd invited me over after the Emmys one night and he said, invite whoever you want. And he did a 3-hour concert.
Just for you and your friends.
Yeah. And I was like asking people at the Emmys, I know I don't really know you, but do you want to come to Prince's?
I have a free ticket to his living room.
Yeah,
do you want to come?
Yes. And that he played for incredible. 3 hours.
Because I knew you. Because I knew you.
So there you have it, some of my favorite reveals from Little Known Facts. Hope you enjoyed it.
Clouds can make the wind blow, bugs can make the grass grow, so there you go. These are little known facts that now you know.
Hey everyone, thank you so much for listening. If you want more information about my guests, go to the website littleknownfactspodcast.com. I also wanted to tell you that there is now a new addition to the website. It is a button that says Contributions. This podcast is a true labor of love, and I really, really want to keep doing it for a long time. So if you like listening as much as I love to do it, please feel free to contribute. It would mean the world to me. Also, on Twitter, you can find me at Alana Levine. Instagram is Little Known Facts Podcast. And on Facebook, Little Known Facts Podcast. You can also feel free to rate and review the show on the iTunes show page. This podcast is recorded at Hanger Studios in New York City. This episode was brought to you by Pro Media. Located in Times Square, Pro Media offers both production and post-production services out of its beautiful studios in the heart of New York City. Pro Media, sound vision. Find out more at promedia.nyc.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with 2 young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the Star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.